set, and the night was now dark, but they could see the water faintly shining as it flowed, and could just make out, on the further side, a thin belt of nut trees and alders. Somewhere beyond, a plover called 3 or 4 times and was silent. One by one, most of the others came up, stopped at the bank, and looked at the water without speaking. The chilly breeze was moving, and several of them trembled where they sat.
"Well, this is a nice surprise, Hazel," said Bigwig at length. "Or were you expecting this when you took us into the wood?"
Hazel realized wearily that Bigwig was probably going to be troublesome. He was certainly no coward, but he was likely to remain steady only as long as he could see his way clear and be sure of what to do. To him, perplexity was worse than danger, and when he was perplexed, he usually grew angry. The day before, Fiver's warning had troubled him, and he had spoken in anger to the Threera and left the Ausla. Then, while he was in an uncertain mood about the idea of leaving the Warren, Captain Holly had appeared in capital time to be attacked and to provide a perfect reason for their departure. Now, at the sight of the river, Bigwig's assurance was leaking again, and unless he, Hazel, could restore it in some way, they were likely to be in for trouble. He thought of the Threera and his wily courtesy.
"I don't know what we should have done without you just now, Bigwig," he said. "What was that animal? Would it have killed us?"
"A Lendri," said Bigwig. "I've heard about them in the Ausla. They're not really dangerous. They can't catch a rabbit that runs, and nearly always you can smell them coming. They're funny things. I've heard of rabbits living almost on top of them and coming to no harm. But they're best avoided all the same. They'll dig out rabbit kittens, and they'll kill an injured rabbit if they find one. They're one of the thousand, all right. I ought to have guessed from the smell, but it was new to me."
"It killed before it met us," said Blackberry with a shudder. "I saw the blood on its lips."
"A rat, perhaps, or pheasant chicks. Lucky for us it had killed, otherwise it might have been quicker. Still, fortunately, we did the right thing. We really came out of it very well," said Bigwig.
Fiver came limping down the path with Pipkin. They, too, checked and stared at the sight of the river.
"What do you think we ought to do now, Fiver?" asked Hazel.
Fiver looked down at the water and twitched his ears.
"We shall have to cross it," he said. "But I don't think I can swim, Hazel. I'm worn out, and Pipkin's a good deal worse than I am."
"Cross it?" cried Bigwig. "Cross it? Who's going to cross it? What do you want to cross it for? I never heard such nonsense."
Like all wild animals, rabbits can swim if they have to, and some even swim when it suits them. Rabbits have been known to live on the edge of a wood and regularly swim a brook to feed in the fields beyond. But most rabbits avoid swimming, and certainly an exhausted rabbit could not swim the inborn.
"I don't want to jump in there," said Speedwell. "Why not just go along the bank?" asked Hawkbit.
Hazel suspected that if Fiver felt they ought to cross the river, it might be dangerous not to. But how were the others to be persuaded? At this moment, as he was still wondering what to say to them, he suddenly realized that something had lightened his spirits. What could it be? A smell? A sound? Then he knew. Nearby, across the river, a lark had begun to twitter and climb. It was morning. A blackbird called 1 or 2 deep, slow notes and was followed by a wood pigeon. Soon they were in a grey twilight and could see that the stream bordered the further edge of the wood. On the other side lay open fields. Chapter 8. The Crossing. The centurion commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land, and the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land. The Acts of the Apostles, chapter 27. The top of the sandy bank was a good 6 feet above the water. From where they sat, the rabbits could look straight ahead upstream and downstream to their left. Evidently, there were nesting holes in the sheer face below them, for as the light grew, they saw 3 or 4 martens dart out over the stream and away into the fields beyond. In a short time, one returned with his beak full, and they could hear the nestlings squeaking as he flew out of sight beneath their feet. The bank did not extend far in either direction. Upstream, it sloped down to a grassy path between the trees and the water. This followed the line of the river, which ran straight from almost as far away as they could see, flowing smoothly without fords, gravel shallows, or plank bridges. Immediately below them lay a wide pool, and here the water was almost still. Away to their left, the bank sloped down again into clumps of alder, among which the stream could be heard chattering over gravel. There was a glimpse of barbed wire stretched across the water, and they guessed that this must surround a cattle wade, like the one in the little brook near the home warren. Hazel looked at the path upstream. "There's grass down there," he said. "Let's go and feed." They scrambled down the bank and set to nibbling beside the water. Between them and the stream itself stood half-grown clumps of purple loosestrife and fleabane, which would not flower for nearly 2 months yet. The only blooms were a few early meadowsweet and a patch of pink butterbur. Looking back at the face of the bank, they could see that it was in fact dotted thickly with marten's holes. There was a narrow foreshore at the foot of the little cliff, and this was littered with the rubbish of the colony, sticks, droppings, feathers, a broken egg, and a dead nestling or two. The martens were now coming and going in numbers over the water. Hazel moved close to Fiver and quietly edged him away from the others, feeding as he went. When they were a little way off and half concealed by a patch of reeds, he said, "Are you sure we've got to cross the river, Fiver? What about going along the bank one way or the other?"
"No, we need to cross the river, Hazel, so that we can get into those fields, and on beyond them too. I know what we ought to be looking for. A high, lonely place with dry soil, where rabbits can see and hear all round, and men hardly ever come. Wouldn't that be worth a journey?"
"Yes, of course it would. But is there such a place?"
"Not near a river. I needn't tell you that. But if you cross a river, you start going up again, don't you? We ought to be on the top and in the open.
But Fiver, I think they may refuse to go much further. And then again, you say all this, and yet you say you're too tired to swim."
"I can rest, Hazel, but Pipkin's in a pretty bad way. I think he's injured. We may have to stay here half the day."
"Well, let's go and talk to the others. They may not mind staying. It's crossing they're not going to fancy, unless something frightens them into it." As soon as they had made their way back, Bigwig came across them from the bushes at the edge of the path.
"I was wondering where you'd got to," he said to Hazel. "Are you ready to move on?"
"No, I'm not,"
answered Hazel firmly.
"I think we ought to stay here until Neafrith. That'll give everyone a chance to rest, and then we can swim across to those fields."
Bigwig was about to reply, but Blackberry spoke first.
"Bigwig," he said, "why don't you swim over now, and then go out into the field and have a look round? The wood may not stretch very far one way or the other. You could see from there, and then we might know which would be the best way to go."
"Oh, well," said Bigwig rather grudgingly, "I suppose there's some sense in that. I'll swim the Embria River as many times as you like. Always glad to oblige."
Without the slightest hesitation, he took two hops to the water, waded in, and swam across the deep, still pool. They watched him pull himself out beside a flowering clump of figwort, gripping one of the tough stems in his teeth, shake a shower of drops out of his fur, and scutter into the alder bushes. A moment later, between the nut trees, they saw him running off into the field. "I'm glad he's with us," said Hazel to Silver. Again he thought wryly of the Threera. "He's the fellow to find out all we need to know.
Oh, I say, look, he's coming back already."
Bigwig was racing back across the field, looking more agitated than he had at any time since the encounter with Captain Holly. He ran into the water almost headlong and paddled over fast, leaving an arrowhead ripple on the calm brown surface. He was speaking as he jerked himself out on the sandy foreshore.
"Well, Hazel, if I were you, I shouldn't wait until Neafrith. I should go now. In fact, I think you'll have to."
"Why?" asked Hazel.
"There's a large dog loose in the wood."
Hazel started.
"What?" he said. "How do you know?"
"When you get into the field, you can see the wood sloping down to the river. Parts of it are open. I saw a dog crossing a clearing. It was trailing a chain, so it must have broken loose. It may be on the Lendry's scent, but the Lendry will be underground by now. What do you think will happen when it picks up our scent, running from one side of the wood to the other with dew on it? Come on, let's get over quickly.
Hazel felt at a loss. In front of him stood Bigwig, sodden, wet, undaunted, single-minded, the very picture of decision. At his shoulder was Fiver, silent and twitching. He saw Blackberry watching him intently, waiting for his lead and disregarding Bigwig's. Then he looked at Pipkin, huddled into a fold of sand, more panic-stricken and helpless than any rabbit he had ever seen. At this moment, up in the wood, there broke out an excited yelping, and a jay began to scold. Hazel spoke through a kind of light-headed trance.
"Well, you'd better get on, then," he said. "And anyone else who wants to? Personally, I'm going to wait until Fiver and Pipkin are fit to tackle it."
"You silly blockhead," cried Bigwig. "We'll all be finished. We'll—"
"Don't stamp about," said Hazel. "You may be heard. What do you suggest, then?"
"Suggest? There's no suggesting to be done. Those who can swim, swim. The others will have to stay here and hope for the best. The dog may not come."
"I'm afraid that won't do for me. I got Pipkin into this, and I'm going to get him out."
"Well, you didn't get Fiver into it, did you? He got you into it."
Hazel could not help noticing with reluctant admiration that although Bigwig had lost his temper, he was apparently in no hurry on his own account and seemed less frightened than any of them. Looking round for Blackberry, he saw that he had left them and was up at the top of the pool where the narrow beach tailed away into a gravel spit. His paws were half buried in the wet gravel and he was nosing at something large and flat on the waterline. It looked like a piece of wood.
"Blackberry," he said, "can you come back here a moment?"
Blackberry looked up, tugged out his paws and ran back.
"Hazel," he said quickly, "that's a piece of flat wood. Like that piece that closed the gap by the green loose above the warren, do you remember? It must have drifted down the river. So it floats. We could put Fiver and Pipkin on it and make it float again. It might go across the river. Can you understand?"
Hazel had no idea what he meant. Blackberry's flood of apparent nonsense only seemed to draw tighter the mesh of danger and bewilderment. As though Bigwig's angry impatience, Pipkin's terror, and the approaching dog were not enough to contend with, the cleverest rabbit among them had evidently gone out of his mind. He felt close to despair.
"Frithra, yes, I see," said an excited voice at his ear. It was Fiver. "Quick, Hazel, don't wait. Come on and bring Pipkin."
It was Blackberry who bullied the stupefied Pipkin to his feet and forced him to limp the few yards to the gravel spit. The piece of wood, hardly bigger than a large rhubarb leaf, was lightly aground. Blackberry almost drove Pipkin onto it with his claws. Pipkin crouched, shivering, and Fiver followed him aboard.
"Who's strong?" said Blackberry. "Bigwig, Silver, push it out!"
No one obeyed him. All squatted, puzzled and uncertain. Blackberry buried his nose in the gravel under the landward edge of the board and raised it, pushing. The board tipped. Pipkin squealed and Fiver lowered his head and splayed his claws. Then the board righted itself and drifted out a few feet into the pool with the two rabbits hunched upon it, rigid and motionless. It rotated slowly, and they found themselves staring back at their comrades.
"Frith and Inley," said Dandelion. "They're sitting on the water. Why don't they sink?" "They're sitting on the wood, and the wood floats, can't you see?" said Blackberry. "Now, we swim over ourselves. Can we start, Hazel?"
During the last few minutes, Hazel had been as near to losing his head as he was ever to come. He had been at his wit's end, with no reply to Bigwig's scornful impatience except his readiness to risk his own life in company with Fiver and Pipkin. He still could not understand what had happened, but at least he realized that Blackberry wanted him to show authority. His head cleared.
"Swim," he said. "Everybody swim!"
He watched them as they went in. Dandelion swam as well as he ran, swiftly and easily. Silver, too, was strong. The others paddled and scrambled over somehow, and as they began to reach the other side, Hazel plunged. The cold water penetrated his fur almost at once. His breath came short, and as his head went under, he could hear a faint grating of gravel along the bottom.
He paddled across awkwardly, his head tilted high out of the water, and made for the figwort. As he pulled himself out, he looked around among the sopping rabbits in the alders.
"Where's Bigwig?" he asked.
"Behind you," answered Blackberry, his teeth chattering. Bigwig was still in the water, on the other side of the pool. He had swum to the raft, put his head against it, and was pushing it forward with heavy thrusts of his back legs.
"Keep still," Hazel heard him say in a quick, gulping voice.
Then he sank, but a moment later he was up again and had thrust his head over the back of the board. As he kicked and struggled, it tilted and then, while the rabbits watched from the bank, moved slowly across the pool and grounded on the opposite side. Fiver pushed Pipkin onto the stones and Bigwig waded out beside them, shivering and breathless.
"I got the idea once Blackberry had shown us," he said, "but it's hard to push it when you're in the water. I hope it's not long to sunrise. I'm cold. Let's get on."
There was no sign of the dog as they made haste through the alders and up the field to the first hedgerow. Most of them had not understood Blackberry's discovery of the raft and at once forgot it. Fiver, however, came over to where Blackberry was lying against the stem of a blackthorn in the hedge.
"You saved Pipkin and me, didn't you?" he said. "I don't think Pipkin's got any idea what really happened, but I have."
"I admit it was a good idea," replied Blackberry. "Let's remember it. It might come in handy again sometime."
Chapter 9. The Crow and the Beanfield. With the beanflower's boon and the blackbird's tune and May and June. Robert Browning, Dicostibus. The sun rose while they were still lying in the thorn. Already several of the rabbits were asleep, crouched uneasily between the thick stems, aware of the chance of danger, but too tired to do more than trust to luck. Hazel, looking at them, felt almost as insecure as he had on the riverbank. A hedgerow in open fields was no place to remain all day. But where could they go? He needed to know more about their surroundings. He moved along the hedge, feeling the breeze from the south, and looking for some spot where he could sit and scent it without too much risk. The smells that came down from the higher ground might tell him something. He came to a wide gap, which had been trodden into mud by cattle. He could see them grazing in the next field, farther up the slope. He went cautiously out into the field, squatted down against a clump of thistles, and began to smell the wind. Now that he was clear of the hawthorn scent of the hedge and the reek of cattle dung, he became fully aware of what had already been drifting into his nostrils while he was lying among the thorn. There was only one smell on the wind, and it was new to him. A strong, fresh, sweet fragrance that filled the air. It was healthy enough. There was no harm in it. But what was it, and why was it so strong? How could it exclude every other smell in open country on a south wind? The source must be close by. Hazel wondered whether to send one of the rabbits to find out. Dandelion would be over the top and back almost as fast as a hare. Then his sense of adventure and mischief prompted him. He would go himself and bring back some news before they even knew that he had gone. That would give Bigwig something to bite on. He ran easily up the meadow toward the cows. As he came, they raised their heads and gazed at him, all together, for a moment, before returning to their feeding. A great black bird was flapping and hopping a little way behind the herd. It looked rather like a large rook, but unlike a rook, it was alone. He watched its greenish, powerful beak stabbing the ground, but could not make out what it was doing. It so happened that Hazel had never seen a crow. It did not occur to him that it was following the track of a mole, in the hope of killing it with a blow of its beak and then pulling it out of its shallow run. If he had realized this, he might not have classed it lightheartedly as a not-hawk, that is, anything from a wren to a pheasant, and continued on his way up the slope.
The strange fragrance was stronger now, coming over the top of the rise in a wave of scent that struck him powerfully, as the scent of orange blossom in the Mediterranean strikes a traveller who smells it for the first time. Fascinated, he ran to the crest. Nearby was another hedgerow, and beyond, moving gently in the breeze, stood a field of broad beans in full flower. Hazel squatted on his haunches and stared at the orderly forest of small, glaucous trees with their columns of black and white bloom. He'd never seen anything like this. Wheat and barley, he knew, and once he'd been in a field of turnips. But this was entirely different from any of those, and seemed, somehow, attractive, wholesome, propitious. True, rabbits could not eat these plants, he could smell that, but they could lie safely among them for as long as they liked, and they could move through them easily and unseen. Hazel determined, then and there, to bring the rabbits up to the bean field to shelter and rest until the evening. He ran back and found the others where he had left them. Bigwig and Silver were awake, but all the rest were still napping uneasily.
"Not asleep, Silver?" he said.
"It's too dangerous, Hazel," replied Silver. "I like to sleep as much as anyone, but if we all sleep and something comes, who's going to spot it?"
"I know. I've found a place where we can sleep safely for as long as we like."
"A burrow?"
"No, not a burrow. A great field of scented plants that will cover us, sight and smell, until we are rested. Come out here and smell it, if you like."
Both rabbits did so.
"You say you've seen these plants?" said Bigwig,
turning his ears to catch the distant rustling of the beans.
"Yes, they're only just over the top. Come on, let's get the others moving before a man comes with a hoodoo, or they'll scatter all over the place."
Silver roused the others and began to coax them into the field. They stumbled out drowsily, responding with reluctance to his repeated assurance that it was only a little way. They became widely separated as they straggled up the slope. Silver and Bigwig led the way, with Hazel and Buckthorn a short distance behind. The rest idled along, hopping a few yards and then pausing to nibble or to pass droppings on the warm, sunny grass. Silver was almost at the crest when suddenly, from halfway up, there came a high screaming, the sound a rabbit makes, not to call for help or to frighten an enemy, but simply out of terror. Fiver and Pipkin, limping behind the others and conspicuously undersized and tired, were being attacked by the crow. It had flown low along the ground. Then, pouncing, it had aimed a blow of its great bill at Fiver, who just managed to dodge in time. Now it was leaping and hopping among the grass tussocks, striking at the two rabbits with terrible darts of its head. Crows aim at the eyes, and Pipkin, sensing this, had buried his head in a clump of rank grass and was trying to burrow further in. It was he who was screaming. Hazel covered the distance down the slope in a few seconds. He had no idea what he was going to do, and if the crow had ignored him, he would probably have been at a loss. But by dashing up, he distracted its attention, and it turned on him. He swerved past it, stopped, and looking back, saw Bigwig come racing in from the opposite side. The crow turned again, struck at Bigwig, and missed. Hazel heard his beak hit a pebble in the grass with a sound like a snail shell when a thrush beats it on a stone. As Silver followed Bigwig, it recovered itself and faced him squarely. Silver stopped short in fear, and the crow seemed to dance before him, its great black wings flapping in a horrible commotion. It was just about to stab when Bigwig ran straight into it from behind and knocked it sideways, so that it staggered across the turf with a harsh, raucous cawing of rage. "Keep at it!" cried Bigwig. "Come in behind it! They're cowards! They only attack helpless rabbits!" But already the crow was making off, flying low with slow, heavy wing beats. They watched it clear the further hedge and disappear into the wood beyond the river. In the silence, there was a gentle, tearing sound as a grazing cow moved nearer. Bigwig strolled over to Pipkin, muttering a ribald Owsler lampoon.
"Hoi, hoi, umblier, there, misayon ulai, raka there."
"Come on, Cleoroo," he said. "You can get your head out now. Having quite a day, aren't we?" He turned away and Pipkin tried to follow him. Hazel remembered that Fiver had said he thought he was injured. Now, as he watched him limping and staggering up the slope, It occurred to him that he might actually be wounded in some way. He kept trying to put his near-side front paw to the ground, and then drawing it up again, hopping on three legs. "I'll have a look at him as soon as they're settled under cover," he thought. "Poor little chap. He won't be able to get much further like that." At the top of the slope, Buckthorn was already leading the way into the bean field. Hazel reached the hedge, crossed a narrow turf verge on the other side, and found himself looking straight down a long, shadowy aisle between two rows of beans. The earth was soft and crumbling, with a scattering of the weeds that are found in cultivated fields. Fumitory, charlock, pimpernel, and mayweed, all growing in the green gloom under the bean leaves. As the plants moved in the breeze, the sunlight dappled and speckled back and forth over the brown soil, the white pebbles and weeds. Yet in this ubiquitous restlessness, there was nothing alarming, for the whole forest took part in it, and the only sound was the soft, steady movement of the leaves. Far along the bean row, Hazel glimpsed Buckthorn's back and followed him into the depths of the field. Soon after, all the rabbits had come together in a kind of hollow. Far around, on all sides, stood the orderly rows of beans, securing them against hostile approach, roofing them over, and covering their scent. They could hardly have been safer underground. Even a little food could be had at a pinch, for here and there were a few pale twists of grass, and here and there a dandelion. "We can sleep here all day," said Hazel. "But I suppose one of us ought to stay awake. And if I take the first turn, it'll give me a chance to have a look at your paw, Clareroo. I think you've got something in it." Pipkin, who was lying on his left side, breathing quickly and heavily, rolled over and stretched out his front paw, underside turned upward. Hazel peered closely into the thick, coarse hair. A rabbit's foot has no pads. And after a few moments, saw what he had expected. The oval shank of a snapped-off thorn sticking out through the skin. There was a little blood, and the flesh was torn. "You've got a big thorn in there, Cleo," he said. "No wonder you couldn't run. We'll have to get it out." Getting the thorn out was not easy, for the foot had become so tender that Pipkin winced and pulled away even from Hazel's tongue. But after a good deal of patient effort, Hazel succeeded in working out enough of the stump to get a grip with his teeth. The thorn came out smoothly, and the wound bled. The spine was so long and thick that Hawkbit, who happened to be close by, woke Speedwell to have a look at it.
"Frith above, Pipkin,"
said Speedwell, sniffing at the thorn where it lay on a pebble.
"You'd better collect a few more like that. Then you can make a notice board and frighten Fiver. You might have poked the Lendry's eye out for us if you'd only known."
"Lick the place, Leo," said Hazel. "Lick it until it feels better, and then go to sleep." Chapter 10 The Road and the Common. Timorous answered that they had got up that difficult place, but, said he, "the further we go, the more danger we meet with. Wherefore, we turned and are going back again." John Bunyan, The Pilgrim's Progress. After some time, Hazel woke Buckthorn. Then he scratched a shallow nest in the earth and slept. One watch succeeded another through the day, though how the rabbits judged the passing of the time is something that civilized human beings have lost the power to feel. Creatures that have neither clocks nor books are alive to all manner of knowledge about time and the weather, and about direction, too, as we know from their extraordinary migratory and homing journeys. The changes in the warmth and dampness of the soil, the falling of the sunlight patches, the altering movement of the beans in the light wind, the direction and strength of the air currents along the ground, all these were perceived by the rabbit awake. The sun was beginning to set when Hazel woke to see Acorn listening and sniffing in the silence between two white-skinned flints. The light was thicker, the breeze had dropped and the beans were still. Pipkin was stretched out a little way away. A yellow and black burying beetle, crawling across the white fur of his belly, stopped, waved its short, curved antennae, and then moved on again. Hazel grew tense with sudden misgiving. He knew that these beetles come to dead bodies, on which they feed and lay their eggs. They will dig away the earth from under the bodies of small creatures, such as shrew mice and fallen fledglings, and then lay their eggs on them before covering them with soil. Surely Pipkin could not have died in his sleep. Hazel sat up quickly. Acorn started and turned toward him, and the beetle scurried away over the pebbles as Pipkin moved and woke. "How's the paw?" said Hazel. Pipkin put it to the ground. Then he stood on it.
"It feels much better," he said. "I think I shall be able to go as well as the others now. They won't leave me behind, will they?"
Hazel rubbed his nose behind Pipkin's ear. "No one's going to leave anyone else behind," he said. "If you had to stay, I'd stay with you. But don't pick up any more thorns, Hearoo, because we may have to go a long way." The next moment, all the rabbits leapt up in panic. From close at hand, the sound of a shot tore across the fields. A peewit rose screaming. The echoes came back in waves, like a pebble rolling round a box, and from the wood across the river came the clattering of wood pigeons' wings among the branches. In an instant, the rabbits were running in all directions through the bean rows, each one tearing, by instinct, toward holes that were not there. Hazel stopped short on the edge of the beans. Looking about him, he could see none of the others. He waited, trembling, for the next shot, but there was silence. Then he felt, vibrating along the ground, the steady tread of a man going away beyond the crest over which they had come that morning. At that moment, Silver appeared, pushing his way through the plants close by. "Hope it's a crow, don't you?" said Silver. "I hope no one's been silly enough to bolt out of this field," answered Hazel. "They're all scattered. How can we find them?"
"I don't think we can," said Silver. "We'd better go back to where we were. They'll come in time."
It was, in fact, a long time before all the rabbits had come back to the hollow in the middle of the field. As he waited, Hazel realized more fully than ever how dangerous was their position. Without holes, wandering in country they did not know. The Lendry, the dog, the crow, the marksman, they had been lucky to escape them. How long would their luck hold? Would they really be able to travel on as far as Fiver's High Place, whatever it might be? "I'd settle for any decent dry bank myself," he thought, "as long as there was some grass and no men with guns. And the sooner we can find one, the better." Hawkbit was the last to return, and as he came up, Hazel set off at once. He looked cautiously out from among the beans and then darted into the hedgerow. The wind, as he stopped to sniff it, was reassuring, carrying only the scents of evening dew, may, and cow dung. He led the way into the next field, a pasture, and here they all fell to feeding, nibbling their way over the grass as easily as though their warren were close by. When he was halfway across the field, Hazel became aware of a hrududu approaching very fast on the other side of the further hedge. It was small and less noisy than the farm tractor which he had sometimes watched from the edge of the primrose wood at home. It passed in a flash of man-made unnatural colour, glittering here and there and brighter than a winter holly tree. A few moments later came the smells of petrol and exhaust. Hazel stared, twitching his nose. He could not understand how the hrududu could move so quickly and smoothly through the fields. Would it return? Would it come through the fields faster than they could run and hunt them down? As he paused, wondering what was best to be done, Bigwig came up.
"There's a route there, then," he said. "That'll give some of them a surprise, won't it?"
"A road?" said Hazel, thinking of the lane by the notice board. "How do you know?"
"Well, how do you suppose a hoodoo-doo can go that fast? Besides, can't you smell it?"
The smell of warm tar was now plain on the evening air.
"I've never smelled that in my life,"
said Hazel, with a touch of irritation.
"Ah," said Bigwig, "but then you were never sent out stealing necklaces for the three-year-old, were you?" If you had been, you'd have learned about roads. There's nothing to them, really, as long as you let them alone by night. They're a little then, all right.
You'd better teach me, I think, said Hazel. I'll go up with you and we'll let the others follow.
They ran on and crept through the hedge. Hazel looked down at the road in astonishment. For a moment he thought that he was looking at another river, black, smooth and straight between its banks. Then he saw the gravel embedded in the tar and watched a spider running over the surface.
But that's not natural, he said,
sniffing the strange, strong smells of tar and oil.
What is it? How did it come there?
It's a man thing, said Bigwig. They put that stuff there, and then the Hrudu deal run on it, faster than we can. And what else can run faster than we?
It's dangerous, then. They can catch us.
No, that's what's so odd. They don't take any notice of us at all. I'll show you, if you like.
The other rabbits were beginning to reach the hedge, as Bigwig hopped down the bank and crouched on the verge of the road. From beyond the bend came the sound of another approaching car. Hazel and Silver watched tensely. The car appeared, flashing green and white, and raced down toward Bigwig. For an instant, it filled the whole world with noise and fear. Then it was gone, and Bigwig's fur was blowing in the whack of wind that followed it down the hedges. He jumped back up the bank among the staring rabbits.
See? They don't hurt you, said Bigwig. As a matter of fact, I don't think they're alive at all. But I must admit, I can't altogether make it out.
As on the river bank, Blackberry had moved away and was already down on the road on his own account, sniffing out toward the middle, halfway between Hazel and the bend. They saw him start and jump back to the shelter of the bank.
What is it? Said Hazel.
Blackberry did not answer, and Hazel and Bigwig hopped toward him along the verge. He was opening and shutting his mouth and licking his lips, much as a cat does when something disgusts it.
You say they're not dangerous, Bigwig, he said quietly, but I think they must be, for all that.
In the middle of the road was a flattened, bloody mass of brown prickles and white fur, with small black feet and snout crushed round the edges. The flies crawled upon it, and here and there the sharp points of gravel pressed up through the flesh.
A yona, said Blackberry. What harm does a yona do to anything but slugs and beetles? And what can eat a yona?
It must have come at night, said Bigwig.
Yes, of course. The yona'll always hunt by night. If you see them by day, they're dying.
I know. But what I'm trying to explain is that at night the Hoododil have great lights, brighter than Frith himself. They draw creatures toward them, and if they shine on you, you can't see or think which way to go. Then the Hoodoo is quite likely to crush you. At least that's what we're taught in the Ausla. I don't intend to try it.
Well, it will be dark soon, said Hazel. Come on, let's get across. As far as I can see, this road's no good to us at all. Now that I've learned about it, I want to get away from it as soon as I can.
By moonrise, they had made their way through Newtown Churchyard, where a little brook runs between the lawns and under the path. Wandering on, they climbed a hill and came to Newtown Common, a country of peat, gorse, and silver birch. After the meadows they had left, this was a strange, forbidding land. Trees, herbage, even the soil, all were unfamiliar. They hesitated among the thick heather, unable to see more than a few feet ahead. Their fur became soaked with the dew. The ground was broken by rifts and pits of naked black peat, where water lay in sharp white stones, some as big as a pigeon's, some as a rabbit's skull, glimmered in the moonlight. Whenever they reached one of these rifts, the rabbits huddled together, waiting for Hazel or Bigwig to climb the further side and find a way forward. Everywhere, they came upon beetles, spiders, and small lizards, which scurried away as they pushed through the fibrous, resistant heather. Once Buckthorn disturbed a snake and leapt into the air as it whipped between his paws to vanish down a hole at the foot of a birch. The very plants were unknown to them. pink lousewort with its sprays of hooked flowers, bog asphodel, and the thin-stemmed blooms of the sundews rising above their hairy, fly-catching mouths, all shut fast by night. In this close jungle, all was silence. They went more and more slowly, and made long halts in the peat cuts. But if the heather itself was silent, the breeze brought distant night sounds across the open common. A cock crowed, a dog ran barking, and a man shouted at it. A little owl called Kiwik, Kiwik. And something, a vole or a shrew, gave a sudden squeal. There was not a noise, but seemed to tell of danger. Late in the night, toward moonset, Hazel was looking up from a cut where they were crouching to a little bank above. As he was wondering whether to climb up to it to see whether he could get a clear view ahead, he heard a movement behind him and turned to find Hawkbit at his shoulder. There was something furtive and hesitant about him, and Hazel glanced at him sharply, wondering for a moment whether he could have sickness or poison on him.
Hazel,
said Hawkbit, looking past him into the face of the dreary black cliff.
That is to say, we can't go on like this. We've had enough of it.
He stopped. Hazel now saw that Speedwell and Acorn were behind him, listening expectantly. There was a pause.
Go on, Hawkbit, said Speedwell. Or shall I? More than enough, said Hawkbit, with a kind of foolish importance.
Well, so have I, answered Hazel, and I hope there won't be much more. Then we can all have a rest.
We want to stop now, said Speedwell. We think it was stupid to come so far.
It gets worse and worse the further we go, said Acorn. Where are we going, and how long will it be before some of us stop running for good and all?
It's the place that worries you, said Hazel. I don't like it myself, but it won't go on forever.
Hawkbit looked sly and shifty.
We don't believe you know where we are going, he said. You didn't know about the road, did you? And you don't know what there is in front of us.
Look here, said Hazel. Suppose you tell me what you want to do, and I'll tell you what I think about it.
We want to go back, said Acorn. We think Fiver was wrong.
How can you go back through all we've come through? Replied Hazel. And probably get killed for wounding an Owsler officer if you ever do get back. Talk sense for Frith's sake.
It wasn't we who wounded Dolly, said Speedwell.
You were there, and Blackberry brought you there. Do you think they won't remember that? Besides...
Hazel stopped as Fiver approached, followed by Bigwig.
Hazel,
said Fiver,
could you come up on the bank with me for a few moments? It's important.
And while you're there, said Bigwig, scowling round at the others from under the great sheaf of fur on his head, I'll just have a few words with these three. Why don't you get washed, Hawkbit? You look like the end of a rat's tail left in a trap. And as for you, Speedwell...
Hazel did not wait to hear what Speedwell looked like. Following Fiver, he scrambled up the lumps and shelves of peat to the overhang of gravelly earth and thin grass that topped them. As soon as Fiver had found a place to clamber out, he led the way along the edge to the bank which Hazel had been looking at before Hawkbit spoke to him. It stood a few feet above the nodding, windy heather, and was open and grassy at the top. They climbed it and squatted down. To their right, the moon, smoky and yellow in thin night cloud, stood over a clump of distant pine trees. They looked southward, across the dismal waste. Hazel waited for Fiver to speak, but he remained silent. "What was it you wanted to say to me?" asked Hazel at last. Fiver made no reply, and Hazel paused in perplexity. From below, Bigwig was just audible.
"And you, Acorn, you dog-eared, dung-faced disgrace to a gamekeeper's gibbet, if only I had time to tell you!"
The moon sailed free of the cloud and lit the heather more brightly, but neither Hazel nor Fiver moved from the top of the bank. Fiver was looking far out beyond the edge of the common. 4 miles away, along the southern skyline, rose the 750-foot ridge of the Downs. On the highest point, the beech trees of Cottington's Clump were moving in a stronger wind than that which blew across the heather.
"Look," said Fiver suddenly. "That's the place for us, Hazel. High, lonely hills, where the wind and the sound carry and the ground's as dry as straw in a barn. That's where we ought to be. That's where we have to get to."
Hazel looked at the dim, far-off hills. Obviously, the idea of trying to reach them was out of the question. It might well prove to be all they could do to find their way across the heather to some quiet field or copse bank like those they had been used to. It was lucky that Fiver had not come out with this foolish notion in front of any of the others, especially as there was trouble enough already. If only he could be persuaded to drop it here and now, there would be no harm done. Unless, indeed, he had already said anything to Pipkin.
"I don't think we could get the others to go as far as that, Fiver," he said. "They're frightened and tired as it is, you know. What we need is to find a safe place soon, and I'd rather succeed in doing what we can than fail to do what we can't."
Fiver gave no sign of having heard him. He seemed to be lost in his own thoughts. When he spoke again, it was as though he were talking to himself.
"There's a thick mist between the hills and us. I can't see through it. But through it we shall have to go. Or into it, anyway."
"A mist?" said Hazel. "What do you mean?"
"We're in for some mysterious trouble," whispered Fiver. "And it's not Elil. It feels more like mist. Like being deceived and losing our way."
There was no mist around them. The May night was clear and fresh. Hazel waited in silence, and after a time, Fiver said slowly and expressionlessly,
"But we must go on until we reach the hills."
His voice sank and became that of a sleep talker.
"Until we reach the hills, the rabbit that goes back through the gap will run his head into trouble. That's running. Not wise. That's running. Not safe. Running. Not..."
He trembled violently, kicked once or twice, and became quiet. In the hollow below, Bigwig seemed to be drawing to a close.
"And now, you bunch of mole-snouted, muck-raking, hutch-hearted sheep-ticks, get out of my sight sharp, otherwise I'll..."
He became inaudible again. Hazel looked once more at the faint line of the hills. Then, as Fiver stirred and muttered beside him, he pushed him gently with one forepaw and nuzzled his shoulder. Fiver started.
"What was I saying, Hazel?"
he asked.
"I'm afraid I can't remember. I meant to tell you..."
"Never mind," answered Hazel. "We'll go down now. It's time we were getting them on again. If you have any more queer feelings like that, keep close to me. I'll look after you." Chapter 11. Hard Going. Then Sir Beaumains rode all that he ever might ride through marshes and fields and great dales. That many times he plunged over the head in deep mires, for he knew not the way, but took the gainest way in that woodness, and at the last him happened to come to a fair green way. Malory, Le Morte d'Arthur. When Hazel and Fiver reached the floor of the hollow, they found Blackberry waiting for them, crouching on the peat and nibbling at a few brown stalks of sedge-grass.
"Hello," said Hazel. "What's happened? Where are the others?"
"Over there," answered Blackberry. "There's been a fearful row. Bigwig told Hawkbit and Speedwell that he'd scratch them to pieces if they didn't obey him. And when Hawkbit said he wanted to know who was Chief Rabbit, Bigwig bit him. Seems a nasty business. Who is Chief Rabbit, anyway, you or Bigwig?"
"I don't know," answered Hazel.
but Bigwig's certainly the strongest. There was no need to go biting Hawkbit. He couldn't have gone back if he'd tried. He and his friends would have seen that if they'd been allowed to talk for a bit. Now Bigwig's put their backs up, and they'll think they've got to go on because he makes them. I want them to go on because they can see it's the only thing to do. There are too few of us for giving orders and biting people. Frith in a fog. Isn't there enough trouble and danger already? They went over to the far end of the pit. Bigwig and Silver were talking with Buckthorn under an overhanging broom. Nearby, Pipkin and Dandelion were pretending to feed on a patch of scrub. Some way away, Acorn was making a great business of licking Hawkbit's throat while Speedwell watched.
"Keep still if you can, poor old chap,"
said Acorn, who obviously wanted to be overheard.
"Just let me clean the blood out. Steady now."
Hawkbit winced in an exaggerated manner and backed away. As Hazel came up, all the rabbits turned and stared at him expectantly. "Look," said Hazel, "I know there's been some trouble, but the best thing will be to try to forget it. This is a bad place, but we'll soon get out of it." "Do you really think we will?" asked Dandelion.
"If you'll follow me now," replied Hazel desperately, "I'll have you out of it by sunrise."
"If I don't," he thought, "they'll very likely tear me to bits, and much good may it do them." For the second time, he made his way out of the pit, and the others followed. The weary, frightening journey began again, broken only by alarms. Once, a white owl swept silently overhead, so low that Hazel saw its dark, searching eyes looking into his own. But either it was not hunting, or he was too big to tackle, for it disappeared over the heather, and although he waited motionless for some time, it did not return. Once Dandelion struck the smell of a stoat, and they all joined him, whispering and sniffing over the ground. But the scent was old, and after a time they went on again. In this low undergrowth, their disorganized progress and uneven, differing rhythms of movement delayed them still more than in the wood. There were continual stampings of alarm, pausing, freezing to the spot at the sound of movement, real or imagined. It was so dark that Hazel seldom knew for certain whether he was leading or whether Bigwig or Silver might not be ahead. Once, hearing an unaccountable noise in front of him, which ceased on the instant, he kept still for a long time, and when at last he moved cautiously forward, found Silver crouching behind a tussock of cocksfoot for fear of the sound of his own approach. All was confusion, ignorance, clambering, and exhaustion. Throughout the bad dream of the night's journey, Pipkin seemed to be always close beside him. Though each of the others vanished and reappeared like fragments floating round a pool, Pipkin never left him, and his need for encouragement became at last Hazel's only support against his own weariness.
"Not far now, Cleoru, not far now," he kept muttering, until he realized that what he said had become meaningless, a mere refrain. He was not speaking to Pipkin or even to himself. He was talking in his sleep, or something very near it.
At last he saw the first of the dawn, like light faintly perceived round a corner at the far end of an unknown burrow, and in the same moment a yellowhammer sang. Hazel's feelings were like those which might pass through the mind of a defeated general. Where were his followers exactly? He hoped not far away, but were they? All of them? Where had he led them? What was he going to do now? What if an enemy appeared at this moment? He had answers to none of these questions, and no spirit left to force himself to think about them. Behind him, Pipkin shivered in the damp, and he turned and nuzzled him, much as the general, with nothing left to do, might fall to considering the welfare of his servant, simply because the servant happened to be there. The light grew stronger, and soon he could see that a little way ahead there was an open track of bare gravel. He limped out of the heather, sat on the stones, and shook the wet from his fur. He could see Fiver's Hills plainly now, greenish-grey and seemingly close in the rain-laden air. He could even pick out the dots of furze bushes and stunted yew trees on the steep slopes. As he gazed at them, he heard an excited voice further down the track.
"He's done it! Did not tell you he'd do it!"
Hazel turned his head and saw Blackberry on the path. He was bedraggled and exhausted, but it was he who was speaking. Out of the heather behind him came Acorn, Speedwell, and Buckthorn. All four rabbits were now staring straight at him. He wondered why. Then, as they approached, he realized that they were looking not at him, but past him, at something further off. He turned round. The gravel track led downhill into a narrow belt of silver birch and rowan. Beyond was a thin hedge, and beyond that, a green field between two copses. They had reached the other side of the common.
"Oh, Hazel,"
said Blackberry, coming up to him round a puddle in the gravel.
"I was so tired and confused, I actually began to wonder whether you knew where you were going. I could hear you in the heather saying, 'Not far now,' and it was annoying me. I thought you were making it up. I should have known better. Frithra, you're what I call a chief rabbit."
"Well done, Hazel," said Buckthorn. "Well done." Hazel did not know what to reply. He looked at them in silence, and it was Acorn who spoke next.
"Come on,"
he said.
"Who's going to be first into that field? I can still run."
He was off, slowly enough, down the slope. When Hazel stamped for him to stop, he did so at once. "Where are the others?" said Hazel. "Dandelion, Bigwig." At that moment, Dandelion appeared out of the heather and sat on the path, looking at the field. He was followed first by Hawkbit and then by Fiver. Hazel was watching Fiver as he took in the sight of the field, when Buckthorn drew his attention back to the foot of the slope. "Look, Hazel," he said. "Silver and Bigwig are down there. They're waiting for us." Silver's light grey fur showed up plainly against a low spray of gorse, but Hazel could not see Bigwig until he sat up and ran toward them.
"Splendid, Hazel," he said. "Everybody's here. Let's get them into that field."
A few moments later, they were under the silver birches, and as the sun rose, striking flashes of red and green from the drops on ferns and twigs, they scrambled through the hedge, across a shallow ditch, and into the thick grass of the meadow. Chapter 12. The Stranger in the Field. Nevertheless, even in a crowded warren, visitors in the form of young rabbits seeking desirable dry quarters may be tolerated, and if powerful enough, they may obtain and hold a place. R.M. Lockley, The Private Life of the Rabbit. To come to the end of a time of anxiety and fear, to feel the cloud that hung over us lift and disperse, the cloud that dulled the heart and made happiness no more than a memory, this at least is one joy that must have been known by almost every living creature. Here is a boy who was waiting to be punished, but then, unexpectedly, he finds that his fault has been overlooked or forgiven, and at once the world reappears in brilliant colours, full of delightful prospects. Here is a soldier who was waiting, with a heavy heart, to suffer and die in battle. But suddenly, the luck has changed. There is news. The war is over, and everyone bursts out singing, "He will go home after all." The sparrows in the ploughland were crouching in terror of the kestrel. But she has gone, and they fly pell-mell up the hedgerow, frisking, chattering, and perching where they will. The bitter winter had all the country in its grip. The hares on the down, stupid and torpid with cold, were resigned to sinking further and further into the freezing heart of snow and silence. But now, who would have dreamed it? The thaw is trickling. The great tit is ringing his bell from the top of a bare lime tree. The earth is scented, and the hares bound and skip in the warm wind. Hopelessness and reluctance are blown away like a fog, and the dumb solitude where they crept, a place desolate as a crack in the ground, opens like a rose and stretches to the hills and the sky. The tired rabbits fed and basked in the sunny meadow as though they had come no further than from the bank at the edge of the nearby copse. The heather and the stumbling darkness were forgotten, as though the sunrise had melted them. Bigwig and Hawkbird chased each other through the long grass. Speedwell jumped over the little brook that ran down the middle of the field, and when Acorn tried to follow him and fell short, Silver joked with him as he scrambled out and rolled him in a patch of dead oak leaves until he was dry. As the sun rose higher, shortening the shadows and drawing the dew from the grass, most of the rabbits came wandering back to the sun-flecked shade among the cow parsley along the edge of the ditch. Here, Hazel and Fiver were sitting with Dandelion under a flowering wild cherry. The white petals spun down around them, covering the grass and speckling their fur, while 30 feet above, a thrush sang, "Cherry dew, cherry dew, knee-deep, knee-deep, knee-deep."
"Well, this is the place all right, isn't it, Hazel?" said Dandelion lazily. "I suppose we'd better start having a look along the bank soon, although I must say I'm in no particular hurry. But I've got an idea it may be going to rain before much longer."
Fiver looked as though he were about to speak, but then shook his ears and turned to nibbling at a dandelion. "That looks a good bank, along the edge of the trees up there," answered Hazel. "What do you say, Fiver? Shall we go up there now, or shall we wait a bit longer?" Fiver hesitated, and then replied, "Just as you think, Hazel."
"Well, there's no need to do any serious digging, is there?" said Bigwig. "That sort of thing's all right for does, but not for us."
"Still, we'd better make one or two scrapes, don't you think?" said Hazel. "Something to give us shelter at a pinch. Let's go up to the copse and look round. We might as well take our time and make quite sure where we'd like to have them. We don't want to have to do the work twice."
"Yes, that's the style," said Bigwig. "And while you're doing that, I'll take Silver and Buckthorn here and have a run down the fields beyond, just to get the lie of the land and make sure there isn't anything dangerous."
The three explorers set off beside the brook, while Hazel led the other rabbits across the field and up to the edge of the woodland. They went slowly along the foot of the bank, pushing in and out of the clumps of red campion and ragged robin. From time to time, one or another would begin to scrape in the gravelly bank, or venture a little way in among the trees and nut bushes to scuffle in the leaf mould. After they had been searching and moving on quietly for some time, they reached a place from which they could see that the field below them broadened out, both on their own side and opposite, the wood edges carved outward away from the brook. They also noticed the roofs of a farm, but some distance off. Hazel stopped, and they gathered round him.
"I don't think it makes much difference where we do a bit of scratching," he said. "It's all good, so far as I can see. Not the slightest trace of Elil. No scent or tracks or droppings. That seems unusual. But it may be just that the home warren attracted more Elil than other places. Anyway, we ought to do well here. Now, I'll tell you what seems the right thing to me. Let's go back a little way, between the woods, and have a scratch near that oak tree there, just by that white patch of stitchwort. I know the farm's a long way off, but there's no point in being nearer to it than we need. And if we are fairly close to the wood opposite, the trees will help break the wind a bit in winter."
"Splendid," said Blackberry. "It's going to cloud over, do you see? Rain before sunset, and we'll be in shelter. Well, let's make a start. Oh, look! There's Bigwig coming back along the bottom, and the other two with him."
The three rabbits were returning down the bank of the stream and had not yet seen Hazel and the others. They passed below them, into the narrower part of the field between the two copses, and it was not until Acorn had been sent halfway down the slope to attract their attention that they turned and came up to the ditch.
"I don't think there's going to be much to trouble us here, Hazel," said Bigwig. "The farm's a good way away, and the fields between don't show any signs of Elil at all. There's a man track, in fact there are several, and they look as though they were used a good deal. Scent's fresh, and there are the ends of those little white sticks that they burn in their mouths. But that's all for the best, I reckon. We keep away from the men, and the men frighten the Elil away."
"Why do the men come, do you suppose?" asked Fiver.
"Who knows why men do anything? They may drive cows or sheep in the fields, or cut wood in the copses. What does it matter? I'd rather dodge a man than a stoat or a fox."
"Well, that's fine," said Hazel.
You'll find out a lot, Bigwig, and all to the good. We were just going to make some scrapes along the bank there. We'd better start. The rain won't be long now, if I know anything about it. Buck rabbits on their own seldom or never go in for serious digging. This is the natural job of a doe making a home for her litter before they are born, and then her buck helps her. All the same, solitary bucks, if they can find no existing holes to make use of, will sometimes scratch out short tunnels for shelter, although it is not work that they tackle at all seriously. During the morning, the digging proceeded in a light-hearted and intermittent way. The bank on each side of the oak tree was bare and consisted of a light, gravelly soil. There were several false starts and fresh choices, but by Nefrith they had three scrapes of a sort. Hazel, watching, lent help here and there and encouraged the others. Every so often he slipped back to look out over the field and make sure that all was safe. Only Fiver remained solitary. He took no part in the digging, but squatted on the edge of the ditch, fidgeting backward and forward, sometimes nibbling, and then starting up suddenly, as though he could hear some sound in the wood. After speaking to him once or twice and receiving no reply, Hazel thought it best to let him alone. The next time he left the digging, he kept away from Fiver and sat looking at the bank, as though entirely concerned with the work. A little while after Nefrith, the sky clouded over thickly. The light grew dull, and they could smell rain approaching from the west. The blue tit that had been swinging on a bramble, singing, "Hey-ho, go and get another bit of moss," stopped his acrobatics and flew into the wood. Hazel was just wondering whether it would be worthwhile starting a side passage to link Bigwig's hole to Dandelion's, when he felt a stamp of warning from somewhere close by. He turned quickly. It was Fiver who had stamped, and he was now staring intently across the field. Beside a tussock of grass, a little way outside the opposite copse, a rabbit was sitting and gazing at them. Its ears were erect, and it was evidently giving them the full attention of sight, smell, and hearing. Hazel rose on his hind legs, paused, and then sat back on his haunches in full view. The other rabbit remained motionless. Hazel, never taking his eyes off it, heard three or four of the others coming up behind him. After a moment he said, "Blackberry?"
"He's down the hole,"
replied Pipkin. "Go and get him." Still the strange rabbit made no move. The wind rose, and the long grass began to flutter and ripple in the dip between them. From behind, Blackberry said,
"You wanted me, Hazel?"
"I'm going over to speak to that rabbit," said Hazel. "I want you to come with me."
"Can I come?"
asked Pipkin. "No, Clearoo. We don't want to frighten him. Three's too many."
"Be careful," said Buckthorn, as Hazel and Blackberry set off down the slope. "He may not be the only one."
At several points the brook was narrow, not much wider than a rabbit run. They jumped it and went up the opposite slope. "Just behave as if we were back at home," said Hazel. "I don't see how it can be a trap, and anyway we can always run." As they approached, the other rabbit kept still and watched them intently. They could see now that he was a big fellow, sleek and handsome. His fur shone, and his claws and teeth were in perfect condition. Nevertheless, he did not seem aggressive. On the contrary, there was a curious, rather unnatural gentleness about the way in which he waited for them to come nearer. They stopped and looked at him from a little distance.
"I don't think he's dangerous," whispered Blackberry. "I'll go up to him first, if you like."
"We'll both go," replied Hazel. But at this moment, the other rabbit came toward them of his own accord. He and Hazel touched their noses together, sniffing, questioning silently. The stranger had an unusual smell, but it was certainly not unpleasant. It gave Hazel an impression of good feeding, of health, and of a certain indolence, as though the other came from some rich, prosperous country where he himself had never been. He had the air of an aristocrat,
and as he turned to gaze at Blackberry from his great brown eyes, Hazel began to see himself as a ragged wanderer, leader of a gang of vagabonds. He had not meant to be the first to speak, but something in the other's silence compelled him.